This is Ozarks at Large for Wednesday, January 16th, 2013. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda. KUAF is supported by the Center for Arkansas and Regional Studies at the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville, dedicated to the celebration and documentation of this region's history and culture.
Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, Governor Mike Beebe welcomes the 89th General Assembly to Little Rock with his State of the State speech, plus Jacqueline Froelich reports on a new study concerning the quality of water near natural gas production in Arkansas.
We also find out what happens at the Botanical Garden of the Ozarks during this month, sometimes referred to as an off month. Robert Ginsburg finds out it is anything but quiet there right now. We also have two more pairs of tickets to next week's Steel Wheels and Three Penny Acre Show at George's Majestic Lounge.
First, Governor Mike Beebe is urging skeptical Republican legislators to expand Arkansas's Medicaid program under the federal health care law. But many Republicans have said they do not want to see an expansion of Medicaid, in part because the state would have to eventually pay for up to 10% of the program. Speaker of the House, Davy Carter, told reporters afterward he's still unclear about the long-term costs of the program.
You know, I've always said this was about making sure we could afford it in the long run. I mean, this is a long-term decision. So I think we take what we said today, look forward to working with him, tomorrow and over the coming weeks on the subject.
Senate President Pro Tem Michael Lamoureux, also a Republican, says he didn't hear anything new in the governor's latest pitch, but did say it was a good, positive start to the session. We'll have more on the governor's State of the State address later in this edition of Ozarks.
The Fort Smith Police Department unveiled a new service yesterday. Drivers involved in minor non-injury vehicle collisions on private property can create accident reports online. Sergeant Daniel Grubbs is the department's public information officer, and he says calls are given a priority level as the department receives them.
And that priority level is the presence or potential for violence, injury. Those are given the highest priorities. So your basic private property accidents are given a very, very low priority. And we answer those calls in order. So there could be, you know, hypothetically, someone sitting in a parking lot that has a minor fender bender, two peaceful people that just accidentally bumped into each other that may have to wait anywhere between 30, 45 minutes to an hour or longer awaiting an officer to come to the scene.
Sergeant Grubbs says aside from saving time for parties involved in an accident, the new system will likely result in increased efficiency for the department.
It's not uncommon for an officer to be busy on maybe a private property accident, and a street accident with injury may come out, or, you know, a hold-up alarm, or some type of active disturbance between people, that person, that officer's tied up with that, and we have to send basically cars from extended distances to respond to that call. So hopefully time will tell that it will show that it'll definitely save, one, gas money of having to cross dispatch officers across our city and save time with people, but, you know, only time will tell on that.
Although police do not have authority to assess fault in accidents on private property, Sergeant Grubbs reiterated the department will never cease responding to incidents if a party feels the additional assistance is necessary.
The Rogers Historical Museum yesterday released its annual report for 2012. This year was positive for the museum. It posted its highest ever number of off-the-street visitors. Overall, the museum served more than 108,000 people through in-house and outreach exhibits, programs, and loaned materials for schools. Museum Director Dr. Gabe Land says there are a couple of reasons for increased attendance last year.
One was the work that we've been doing ourselves to make the museum more visible around Northwest Arkansas through marketing, through putting our community exhibits out in more places, and those always come with a place for rack cards and information about what's going on here at the museum to get people back to us.
But while increased marketing efforts brought in some additional visitors, Gabe Lyon says additional growth was influenced by what she calls the Crystal Bridges effect.
Part of that growth in visitation we definitely could see was coming from people who were from outside this area, and they would not have been impacted by the marketing efforts that we were making other than the things that we do through Facebook or on our website. So I think they were people, and this was partly anecdotal from asking them, they were people who had come to Northwest Arkansas mostly to visit Crystal Bridges, but they had come from far enough away that they were choosing to stay overnight, and so they were looking for other things to do. And at that point, they picked up on us as an option.
Also listed among the major accomplishments in the museum's report was the receipt of a nearly $148,000 grant.
The city of Fayetteville last night tabled a decision until its next meeting on whether to sell nearly 2 acres of the former Tyson Mexican Original Campus. Come and Go originally offered the city $900,000 for the land, plus shared costs for demolition of the factory and other development costs. But a last-minute offer of $1 million by Casey's General Store for the same property triggered a revised matching offer from Come and Go. Aldermen agreed to table the issue in order to take sealed offers from both Iowa-based convenience chains. The city originally paid $1.1 million for the nearly 11-acre campus in 2004.
The Fort Smith Board of Directors last night voted for urban deer hunts to take place at Chaffee Crossing. According to the citywire.com, city directors voted 4-3 in favor of the urban archery program. But because the board failed to secure a 5-vote majority, the ordinance must also pass second and third readings before final approval.
The issue of whether the Walton Arts Center Council is subject to the state's Freedom of Information Act is still undecided. According to the opinion released yesterday by Attorney General Dustin McDaniel's office, only a finder of fact can determine whether the Arts Center Council is supported by public funds and that the office is not authorized to make such an inquiry. However, the opinion did state that the question of whether the Arts Center Council is subject to FOI laws depends on whether there is sufficient alignment with government or intertwining of functions so as to trigger the open records law.
Two projects by the Fay Jones School of Architecture at the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville have earned national 2013 honor awards from the American Institute of Architects. One of those projects was the St. Nicholas Orthodox Christian Church in Springdale, designed by Fayetteville-based architect Marlon Blackwell, who also heads the university's architecture department. The building, which saw the transformation from a metal shop building into a sanctuary and fellowship hall, received an honor award for architecture. The other project honored was the Rock Street Pocket Housing Project in Little Rock. That project received an honor award for regional and urban design and was a product of the University of Arkansas Community Design Center. The award makes the 10th honor award for regional and urban design for the center.
Tonight's weather forecast calls for partly cloudy conditions with lows from 23 in northwest Arkansas to 27 in the Arkansas River Valley. Tomorrow, expect mostly sunny skies with highs from 43 degrees in northwest Arkansas to 49 degrees in the Arkansas River Valley. And tomorrow night, expect clear conditions with lows from 19 degrees in northwest Arkansas to 26 in the Arkansas River Valley. Owned freshwater wells in north-central Arkansas in proximity to unconventional natural gas drilling are the subject of a newly released baseline study. The collaborative project, coordinated by the Arkansas U.S. Geological Survey Groundwater Resources Program, was the first of its kind in the nation. And as Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports, the results released last week were surprising.
The so-called Fayetteville Shale, which lies beneath a six-county region in north-central Arkansas, ranges from 50 to 600 feet in thickness, located at depths from 1,500 to 6,000 feet deep. The grayish-black shale contains pockets of methane gas extracted by boring vertically into it, then horizontally through it. The shale is then hydrofracked using millions of gallons of water mixed with silica sand and tons of chemical surfactants, biocides, and petroleum distillates, including benzene, toluene, and xylene. The vertical bores are cased in cement to prevent water contamination, but certain residents living near drill sites worry their drinking water may be impaired by flowback water from the wells, failed casings, or produced fluid migrating underground. Tom Kimmins is director of the Shirley Community Development Corporation, a three-county environmental and economic development group based in northeast Van Buren County.
Yeah, they did have concern with taste in their wells, odor in their wells. They all just wanted to know what we wanted to know. What's going on here? What do we got here?
Kimmins, who you can hear is recovering from a cold, is also a biologist and serves on a regional gas advisory board established several years ago by the Van Buren Quorum Court. It funded the first ever sampling of surface and groundwater for hazardous chemicals associated with the gas drilling.
Now, we were novices at this. At the time, we didn't realize that BTEX, the benzene, xylene, toluene, all these carbon tetrachloride, we didn't realize that these really caustic and carcinogenic chemicals were really hard to find. And in the process of working with the chemist, I ran into Tim Creasy down at USGS, and he was telling me, no, you're doing this all wrong. You don't want to go in there and try to test for these volatiles. You want to go in there and test for the counterpart of these volatiles, which are the chlorides that are down naturally occurring at the bottom of these fracked wells. These are the chlorides, calcium chloride, sodium chloride. And what happens, these salts or these chlorides, if there is a rupture or a break, they'll leach out and they'll form chloride plumes.
The chloride plumes, which bubble up into fresh water tables from fracked gas wells, could lead scientists to more discrete frack contaminants. So Kimmins and the nonprofit Shirley Community Development Board joined forces with Tim Creasy and his team at Arkansas U.S. Geologic Survey to conduct a baseline sampling of 127 private domestic wells on Van Buren as well as Faulkner counties at no cost to residents.
And I think 75 of those were in Van Buren County. I was there at every well. I went out with them, and our group had kind of oversight of what was going on. And it was all done very professionally in a timely manner.
USGS agent Tim Creasy was out in the field, but Jim Peterson, chief of the Hydrologic Investigations Program at USGS Arkansas Water Science Center in Little Rock, speaking on behalf of the team, said the sampling was a cooperative effort between their agency and local residents.
To help keep down the cost, the representatives of in Van Buren County and Faulkner County helped us by soliciting landowners who had shallow wells that they were, had some concerns about, or they just wanted to find out about the water quality.
Jim Peterson says groundwater is sparse in the region, confined to isolated fractures with no large continuous underground aquifers. Rural municipal water districts tend to draw from surface water impoundments. Since 2005, more than 4,000 hydrofracked wells have been drilled on the Fayetteville Shale, with more than 900 billion cubic feet of gas extracted in 2011 alone. For this study, water wells were chosen in various proximities to those drill sites.
And what we found was that the chloride concentrations that were collected back in 2011 weren't higher. In fact, they're actually lower than our historic data. So that's the first thing. And then the second was that our comparison between 2 miles versus 2 miles or less versus 2 miles or more, there was no significant difference, no statistically significant difference between chloride concentrations in those two groups of wells.
Jim Peterson said they also sampled for methane in domestic wells,
which is natural gas. And we looked at a subset of those 127 wells. We looked at 57 domestic wells. And the methane that we found, based on isotope data, was all a type of methane that would not be the methane that's coming from the Fayetteville Shale. So there's three lines of evidence there that are indicating that we're not seeing any contamination.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful findings. Very positive. It's great. Great to hear and great to see that we have a great baseline set up, and that there has been no contamination regionally with gas development in the Fayetteville Shale.
That's Peyton Rose, an independent licensed electrician who lives in Damascus, which borders Van Buren and Faulkner counties. He works with Arkansans for Responsible Gas Development, an affiliate group of the Arkansas Public Policy Panel based in Little Rock. He says he trusts the results of the USGS sampling.
Tim Creasy is, I think, without a doubt, a very pragmatic scientist, unbiased scientist, and very, he's an expert, knowledgeable as they come. So he's going to be on the up and up with everything. And the leaders that we had involved are also absolutely and positively not influenced by industry.
As industry attempts to skew public opinion via television and print ads, it's also gotten into the business of research science. A University of Texas Austin Energy Institute shale gas industry water quality study was discredited last year after a scientist was found to have gas industry connections, as did a University of Buffalo Shale Resources and Society Institute research project. But Jim Peterson says USGS has no vested interests. The $225,000 study was funded in part by the Shirley Community Development Corporation, which contributed $8,000 in cash and provided in-kind volunteer hours. But the project would have cost much more were it not for Duke University's Environmental Isotope Lab, which conducted expensive methane water tests for free. The Arkansas Department of Environmental Quality provided organic analysis data, and the Arkansas Natural Resources Commission and members of the Arkansas Oil and Gas Commission provided technical support.
You know, it is a baseline in the sense that at least, you know, maybe 3 years down the road, 10 years down the road, people can come back and sample some of these same wells and see what kind of changes have occurred over that period of time.
Van Buren County resident Tom Kimmins says Fayetteville Shale Water Quality Study stakeholders now have a firm footing.
Oh, my reaction was I was glad they didn't find any, you know, real poison in people's wells. At the same time, we weren't so much trying to find a smoking gun as establish a baseline.
Since 2008, more than $18 billion in economic activity was generated by the Fayetteville shale gas industry, including $1.2 billion in lease and royalty payments to landowners. Of course, now we're seeing a natural gas glut. As a result, Tom Kimmins says the shale gas activity has almost come to a standstill. On any given day, 2 years ago, more than 200 trucks would lumber down local highways near him. Today, he says, only a few go by. But the Fed, looking to build a liquefied natural gas export infrastructure, the chances of the Fayetteville shale going into full-bore production again are good. As such, residents should be on guard, says Peyton Rose.
One thing is that we do definitely need to do follow-up tests. Follow-up tests will be crucial in the upcoming years as gas development continues in the Fayetteville shale. So I'm very excited that we found no contaminants. I don't think very many people were expecting to find contaminants, especially regionally. But every landowner should get their water tested and should do follow-up testing. We should all do follow-up testing in the future for sure.
The good news is that chloride tests cost only $15 each. States like Colorado are enforcing baseline testing by the shale gas industry prior to, during, and after a well is hydrofracked, as the natural gas industry is currently exempt from most major federal environmental laws. The Arkansas Public Policy Panel will push the state legislature for a landowner's bill of rights this session. The Arkansas USGS Water Quality Study is the first regional sampling of its kind in the nation. Very good news. And at the same time Arkansas launched its study, EPA undertook its own study over five states, not including Arkansas, with results due in 2014. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
The report is titled Shallow Groundwater Quality and Geochemistry in the Fayetteville Shale Gas Production Area, North Central Arkansas 2011. It is available online at pubs.usgs.gov. That's pubs.usgs.gov.
Support for KUAF comes from the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal, featuring entrepreneurs in the January 21st edition, plus local business news in Northwest Arkansas. The current edition is available at 725-0394 or nwabusinessjournal.com, where you can also register for the daily business e-news.
Ahead on Ozarks, Robert Ginsburg takes a two-wheeled approach to the Botanical Garden of the Ozarks. He rides his bike from our studio to the BGO to discover that even though the gardens are closed and to the public this month, the work continues. And tomorrow on our program, we go back inside the Furman Garner Performance Studio for more live music. RJ Michaud, Corey Montgomery, and Garrett Jones will give us a two-song preview of their first-of-its-kind collaboration Saturday night in Bentonville at the Metro. Live music for your lunch hour tomorrow at noon on Ozarks at Large.
Facing doping allegations, Lance Armstrong had a tough relationship with sports reporters.
It is very telling, I think, that when he ultimately decides to come clean, he does it with someone who's not from that world.
Oprah Winfrey, Lance Armstrong, and the Fallen Cyclist's media strategy today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered this afternoon beginning at 3 on KUAF 91.3 FM.
This is Ozarks at Large. The Arkansas House and the Arkansas Senate are now on their regular schedule after the ceremony of Monday's first day and the traditional State of the State speech yesterday by Governor Mike Beebe. The governor addressed a joint session of the legislature yesterday morning and used the opportunity to once again make his case for expanded Medicaid for Arkansas. Ozarks at Large's Timothy Dennis has this report on the speech.
Although he touched on topics of education and economic development, Governor Mike Beebe spent most of his time before state lawmakers addressing issues with the state's Medicaid system. He says that the size of the shortfall to the state's Medicaid budget has been a moving target, but the rising share paid by the state, coupled with rising health care costs, has led to a $300 million budget shortfall in the state's system. Governor Beebe assured lawmakers that money would be available to close the gap, at least in part.
My proposed budget includes $90 million in new ongoing general revenue and $70 million in one-time surplus funds. Even after we calculate revised numbers, we will still be short of our full funding for our existing Medicaid programs. The vast majority of our Kansans who currently receive Medicaid services are either elderly, nursing home residents, disabled adults, or children insured by Our Kids First. There are no easy cuts to make around the margins.
Aside from ensuring the solidity of existing services, the governor urged lawmakers to enact federally backed expansions to the state's Medicaid system in order to expand coverage to households that don't currently qualify for Medicaid but otherwise couldn't afford health insurance.
Very rarely do adults of working age qualify for Medicaid, and rising costs have led more companies to drop insurance coverage for their employees. These families and individuals are often referred to as the working poor. And we have a real chance to provide them better access to health care. Just last summer, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld the Affordable Care Act as constitutional. The benefits, costs, and insurance mandates that you like or dislike about the law many call Obamacare will continue going into effect this year and the next.
Expansions to the Medicaid system could reportedly provide health insurance for up to 250,000 Arkansans who are currently unable to purchase affordable health care. Starting next year, the cost for insuring those Arkansans would be completely covered by the federal government. The state would begin chipping in a share for the costs in 2017, gradually increasing to a maximum share of 10% in 2020. While he said he is concerned about the effect of the national debt, Governor Beebe told lawmakers that trying to offset the debt should be done in Washington and not in Little Rock.
We balance our budgets, and we don't need to sacrifice our share of federal money to other states. Refusing money to help our people may make a statement to the federal government, but it will cost us more at home, will jeopardize the health of our fellow Arkansans, and won't solve the problems of our national counterparts.
Governor Beebe says he will continue to make his case for expanding the state's Medicaid system, but that the final decision lies in the hands of the legislature. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Timothy Dennis.
Bentonville-based Walmart employs 1.4 million workers in the United States, and the company will be expanding its ranks by hiring 100,000 veterans over the next 5 years. Joining Forces is an initiative led by First Lady Michelle Obama to connect U.S. veterans to more than 2,000 American businesses to provide them more job opportunities. Yesterday at the National Retail Federation Annual Convention in New York, Walmart's U.S. President and CEO Bill Simon announced his company's commitment to that effort, characterizing veterans as top talent. A spokesperson for the Department of Veterans Affairs, Josephine Schuta, agrees.
The Department of Veterans Affairs commends Walmart for their leadership and strong commitment to hire veterans. Walmart's positive example will help more businesses understand that veterans make exceptional employees who possess character, team-building skills, and discipline that will help their businesses grow and succeed. As the president said in his address to Congress and the nation, we ask these men and women to leave their careers, leave their families, and risk their lives to fight for our country. The last thing they should have to do is fight for a job when they come home. We at VA could not agree more.
The unemployment rate for Gulf War era vets is about 10% for men, nearly 16% for women. Since joining forces was launched in 2011, more than 125,000 veterans and military spouses have been hired, with a 250,000 more expected in the next few years. And starting Memorial Day, Walmart says it will offer a job to any recently honorably discharged veteran at Walmart stores, Sam's Clubs, distribution centers, and the home office in Bentonville. Bill Simon also announced that Walmart and Sam's Club will purchase an additional $50 billion in U.S. products over the next 10 years and help part-time associates who seek to be full-time make that transition. It is Wednesday, January 16th, 2013. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
With us in the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio is Becca Martin Brown. She is features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
If you had a New Year's resolution that you were going to get out of the house, at 6 o'clock tonight, there's a new mystery book club at the Bella Vista Library.
All right.
I don't know what they're reading. I think they're going to decide in the future. It's a mystery. But if your resolution was to get out and do more, there's a free opportunity.
I think almost every day for the last few days, you've given us a free opportunity.
Mm-hmm. We like to do that.
Yeah, we do.
If you're a member of Crystal Bridges, tonight is Wednesday Over Water, when fun things happen there. And if you like the comedy scene, this is worse than me talking about music because I don't get it. But our music writer, Kevin Kinder, says that you should go see Ralphie May.
Okay.
He grew up in Clarksville.
Yes, he did.
Which I think is interesting. And he's back in the area for shows tonight at 7 o'clock at the Movie Lounge in Fort Smith and 8 o'clock tomorrow night at the York Bowl in Fayetteville. Both shows are $20. Each show is $20. Let me get that correct, Catherine, if you're listening. And his Fayetteville appearance kicks off a winter comedy series that also includes people I have no idea who they are. But their names are Mo Alexander, Roy Haber, David Nickerson, Mike Brown, and Stuart Huff.
Stuart Huff is returning.
He's coming back.
That's fantastic news.
See, there you go.
Okay.
You can find out more at uarkbowl.com.
You've made my day.
Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin-Brown is features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
And after a few days of overcast, gloomy conditions, most of the region enjoyed full sunlight on this Wednesday. A similar day last week tempted Robert Ginsburg to leave the indoors, hop on his bicycle, and ride to the Botanical Garden of the Ozarks, located on the Springdale-Fayetteville border. His trip and his discoveries follow.
Robert Ginsburg here, rogue reporter for Ozarks at Large. I'm on my bike today and heading up the trail from downtown Fayetteville to the Botanical Garden of the Ozarks, taking advantage of one of those wonderful January days in Northwest Arkansas where the temperature is in the upper 50s, the sun is out, the wind is still, and it's a great day to be on the trail. But I have a mission. I want to see what goes on at the Botanical Garden of the Ozarks during their off season. The Botanical Garden, of course, is located right on the line between Fayetteville and Springdale, just off of 265 adjacent to Lake Fayetteville. And they are officially open 11 months a year, with January being their down month. But there's a lot that goes on those down months in the winter months, and all of it in preparation to creating the wonderful gardens that you see in the spring and in the summer and the fall. So I'm going to take advantage of this day and do about the 10 or 11 mile bike ride up from Poplar Street up to the Botanical Gardens, and we'll talk with Gerald Klingemann and see who else we can scare up. Kind of surprised there's not that many people on the trail today. As gorgeous as it is, here's some folks. Hello.
After arriving at the Botanical Gardens, I meet up with Gerald Klingemann, a former horticulture professor, retired, who is now the director of operations. Among his other duties, Gerald oversees construction projects at the Botanical Gardens.
Gerald, it looks like you've neared completion on a wonderful project here. Why don't you tell me about it?
This is our new wetland bridge walkway, and it's a walkway that goes through our wetlands. When we have a stormwater flood, it collects and then drains away as it dries out. And so it'll be a connector for the streamside trail that's under development now, too.
When there was heavy rains, this was an area that was just inaccessible before. So you've built this walkway that kind of meanders through an area that floods, and this will keep everybody above the fray. Why don't we walk out on here, and you can tell me a little bit more about the construction and what's on either side of the trail.
This is one of the composite wood bridges, and it's just built so that it comes out right at flood stage. When the pond is completely full, the water will be just right at the top of the bridge. So that'll give a nice interaction. Then we've got it planted with cattails and some hibiscus and other plants that will tolerate flooding. They'll flood, then the water goes away, and the plants just go on fine. And we've got a number of those kinds of species along here. This little area is under development. We've got a couple things planned. One, we'd like to have a bird viewing area. Susan Regan is interested in putting that in, and it'll probably be in this area. And then the other thing that we want to do is we want to have a suspension bridge at this point that goes across the stream so that there can be a circle between this bridge and a bridge we have further down the way.
And we're looking across to the southern field, which is where the farmer's market is staged during the months that it's in operation.
Right. The farmer's market is just now actually operating on the weekends, and they're doing a winter market as a test and see how that works. And so they're every Saturday morning from 10 till 2, I believe. And so far they've been seem to be having pretty good attendance at the market. That whole field on the south side of the creek is open at the moment, but later this spring, hopefully in the next 4 to 6 weeks, we'll be getting our first big shipment of shade trees that'll go into the arboretum planting we've got scheduled for there. I enjoy the plants. That's a first passion, but I've always liked to build things, and that's one of the things I enjoy about this place is there's a limitless number of projects that can be undertaken. And at the moment, we're building the other lean-to on our educational annex. A little barn is actually the first timber frame building that was built on the site back, I believe, in 2000. They put it up. Last summer, we hired a building mover, and he brought it across the stream and located it in the children's garden. And so now we're adding another wing to it so that it will, if we do have a lot of kids out here and have a rain, they've got a place they can get out of the rain. So it's just more covered space for us. And we'll use it in a lot of our educational programming.
I follow Gerald onto the roof of the annex to the educational facility, where he's installing plywood and cutting blocking using a nail gun driven by a 35-year-old air compressor that you hear quacking in the background.
It looks like you're on the home stretch here. You're about to get the roof on. The framework is there. You've got the nail guns out.
Gerald's done all this in the last 2 days. He's fast. He's very fast.
Well, I try to keep my thumb out of the way. It'll be ready certainly by the time we get the first classes out here.
Next, I'm off to the greenhouse where I meet up with the horticulture team. Lissa Morrison and Holly Shields are part of the winter crew, and Susan Regan is the director of garden design and management.
It looks like there's a lot going on here. Why don't you fill me in on what the winter activities in the greenhouse entail?
Well, first thing that we do is we dig up a lot of plants. And so half of the greenhouse right now is things that we harvest off of, you know, make new cuttings off of, save, you know, to put back out in large form each year. And then the other half of the greenhouse goes into production. We haven't really gone into high production yet. We're getting ready to start all our seedlings and all our cuttings. And we plan the year as we go along. We don't have the thing. If you asked me what it's going to look like this year, I would not be able to tell you. I might be able to tell you, you know, some of the plants that we hope to grow, but it's always a surprise. But we do try to change it up every year. And the fact that we do all our own growing, we can really control that.
Pretty soon here, we'll go into high production with the cuttings and the seeds that we start. And that's when we get to go through the catalogs and get excited about some new look or new plant or new perennial that we hope to put out in the garden to inspire people to garden at home.
Can you walk me around the greenhouse and show me some of the things that you're involved in here now?
Sure. So on our mist bench right now, what we have started are the beginning of December, some seedlings got started that we want to have ready for the early spring. So there's some snapdragons, some ranunculus, and then we started some vegetables for a new little greenhouse that we built just to kind of have some winter interest as far as vegetables go. So we started some mustard, spinach, kale, and Swiss chard.
So these are all laid out on a metal rack here on sawhorses, and this is the misting apparatus up above it?
Yes. It comes on every minute. It goes off like maybe just for 2 seconds. It's just enough to keep the soil moist. And then underneath them we have heating pads just to give them that bottom heat.
Continuing on now, we're getting into some plants that it looks like maybe you've pulled in from outdoors.
Yes, we do a lot of digging up in the fall before any hard freezes happen. What you're looking at here is coleus, some lantana, some flowering maple. We do all sorts of plants, and then what we do, we use these as mother plants. So we're going to take cuttings off of them to get the numbers we want for out in the gardens. It's a way to money saver, number one. And then also you just have larger plants to start with whenever you go out in the spring. We'll have bigger plants to, you know, start March and April off with.
We're in the winter vegetable garden right next to the chicken coop with Susan Jenkins. This is your responsibility during the season, but here you are in January. What's going on in the winter garden?
Well, of course, not much is going on in the winter garden, although the spinach still looks pretty good and some of the herbs are looking fabulous. But right now what I'm doing is preparing the beds for next year. And what I'm doing is raking off any mulch that we have on top and putting a layer of cardboard. Worms seem to love cardboard, so we're putting down a layer of cardboard, and then I put mulch on top of that again, and the cardboard breaks down, and hopefully the worms will come, and in the spring, then we'll rake the whole deal off, and we'll be ready to start planting. But right now, we're just putting the beds to bed.
One can't help but be impressed with the ingenuity of the crew at the botanical gardens. Armed with hand tools and a small Kubota tractor and a little John Deere four-wheeler, they accomplish more than seems humanly possible at times.
Yes, so we love this John Deere because it does a lot of work for us. It has made a huge difference. We get a lot more done.
Little four-wheeler.
Yes, it's got a dump on the back, which means we dump our trash easily. It's wonderful.
coffee.
They're cute. They're so red. Oh, yeah.
They're dragons.
This is who we are.
Reporting from the Botanical Gardens of the Ozarks for Ozarks at Large, this is Robert Ginsberg.
Robert Ginsberg can also be heard each Friday night and Saturday night on KUAF at 10 with his program Shades of Jazz. Of course, if you bike to the Botanical Garden of the Ozarks, you have to bike back.
So delightful to be able to make this trek on my bike without hardly having to get out on the street with traffic. Oh, there's a dog off his leash. Watch it, Pooch. Move your assets off the trail.
Sager Creek Art Center in Siloam Springs announces the upcoming production of In This House, a thought-provoking musical representative of the new musical theater genre, February 22nd, 23rd, and 24th. It's the story of two couples brought together by a minor car accident and forced to spend New Year's Eve in an abandoned home. You can also check out Sager Creek Art Center on Facebook to find special deals at local restaurants and coffee shops on performance nights. To reserve tickets, 479-524-4000.
What do I have in my hands here?
You have some tickets.
To Three Penny Acre and the Steel Wheels, Tuesday night, the 22nd. That's the upcoming Tuesday. We're going to give these away in just a few minutes.
Yes, so I hope you are up to date on your sports knowledge.
That's the tease. Okay, that's coming up in just a few minutes.
President Obama draws a red line on the debt ceiling.
We are not a deadbeat nation.
And considers the vice president's recommendations on gun control while Congress takes on Sandy relief. I'm Celeste Headlee. Political junkie Ken Rudin returns, plus our favorite speechwriting duo previews the president's inaugural address. Next, Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation today at 1 here on KUAF 91.3 FM.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kelms. With me in the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio is Wayne Bell. And Wayne, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
It is, boy, award season. It started Sunday night with Golden Globes. Last week we had the
Critics' Choice.
And the nominations
and
the Oscar
nominations.
So, first of all, your thoughts on the Oscar nominations. No real surprises.
I wouldn't say that.
Okay.
I left that with the two biggest jaw droppers that I can remember, which are how would you omit Ben Affleck and Catherine Bigelow? I don't understand.
For best director.
But, yeah, I mean, I'm thrilled that like the director of Beasts of the Southern Wild get in there and all that, but that it's crazy. If you were to ask me, place everybody, you know, in any category where you think, you know, who has the best shot of getting a nomination of any kind. I mean, those two would have been right up there at the top.
But you do have this mathematical problem where you're going to have as many as 10 movies nominated for Best Picture and only still 5 nominated for Director. So some Best Picture nominees are not going to get a Director nomination.
That's true, but I would have never picked those two. You know, with Catherine Bigelow, you kind of have to wonder what is going on there, because she had won most of the critics' prizes going into last week.
And she is the director of Zero Dark Thirty, which has raised some controversy in Washington about where she received some of her information in this movie about the hunt for Osama bin Laden.
And this apparently pro-torture stance that the movie does not take.
Right.
I watched it twice over the weekend. There's no possible way that I feel like that, but you do kind of have to wonder if it's because of something else, meaning I've heard a lot of film critics say it was fine when she was a female director and won for The Hurt Locker a few years ago.
First woman to win the Best Director.
But then this is different now. This is very threatening. This isn't a little movie. And when you're talking about the director's branch, which is about 300 members and mostly men, it is threatening. And Ben Affleck, that is ridiculous. From everything that I've read and heard, and even some Academy members who were questioned about it, the consensus seemed to be that everybody thought he was in, so they voted for smaller directors because they knew he would be in anyway. And when... I mean, he was set to win, and he won the Critics' Choice the other night, and he won the Golden Globe. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think he would have won. I mean, I really do feel like if he would have got in there, he would have won because they love actor-turned-directors.
Kevin Costner won. Right. Redford
and Spielberg's
won.
Already won a couple. Bigelow had already won. Ang Lee's already won. I mean, it's really bizarre that happened. But, you know, it's happened in the past. Ron Howard took a long time. He would win DGA and he would win all sorts of awards and then never get nominated for Oscars. So.
Spielberg himself has been considered a lock for a nomination and not earned one in years
I think
past.
Those are kind of the big surprises. And then, of course, you know, a couple of John Hawkes for The Sessions. That's an omission, maybe because it's a smaller movie.
But you're always going to have some omissions. You're always going to have some that you could say, wow, if there was a six nomination,
but then to see
person.
Other things get in and do so well, like Beasts of the Southern Wild, which was a small movie but really loved, you know, that's really nice. And I thought that Seth MacFarlane and Emma Stone gave us a nice preview of what it'll be like when he hosts the Oscars, because he was kind of charming and dashing and kind of made that announcement fun.
You've seen most of the nominees for Best Picture.
Yeah, and you've seen quite a few. What did you see over the weekend?
I saw Silver Linings Playbook and Argo.
Okay, so what do you think?
Neither would get my vote for Best Picture. Silver Linings Playbook, I thought for two-thirds, was a very interesting movie and a very interesting look at bipolar and unflinching. I think you either buy or don't buy the last third of the movie. It becomes, I thought a lot. I didn't think it was a bad movie, but I think ultimately it's the best romantic comedy I've seen in years.
Okay.
The performances were fantastic.
So can you explain to me why she would be so obsessed with running after him? Because
no.
That never bought to me. I never, from a romantic comedy standpoint, I appreciate the performances, but I never once understood like why she would become so
enamored.
Yeah, there was nothing, no buildup
no.
for that.
And I think, and we don't want to give away, but the last third where this sort of narrative device comes that will build to
it's
the climax.
The dance thing.
I didn't buy it at all.
No.
The dancing alone I did, but not the reason the dance had to be good.
Right.
It just didn't work.
Seemed a little artificial.
Tried. Yes. Now, I thought Bradley Cooper, I thought Jennifer Lawrence, I thought there were
Jackie
several.
Weaver, I love, and Robert De Niro.
They're great. They were. And so I thought it was – I'm glad I went to the movie.
There's problems with it, though.
I agree.
There's a lot of problems. And if Jennifer Lawrence is a co-favorite to win Best Actress, that's weak. Because I personally, she has one scene in the diner, but the rest of it, it's not her movie for Best Actress.
Right.
It's his story. It's his parents. We never even really meet her parents.
Yeah.
I mean, so it's kind of, that's a strange choice, but she's pretty, so they'll probably go for that.
The woman who plays Bradley Cooper's mother?
Oh, yeah, I love her.
I was surprised that she was not nominated for Best
Supporting. No, she is.
Oh, she is.
Jackie Weaver.
That's right. Well, she's fantastic.
No,
she's fantastic.
All four of them are. First movie since Reds to have four acting nominations.
Now.
Argo?
Argo is a great watch. But here's
the most fun movie of the year.
Yes. Here is a problem with it. And here is why I don't feel at all bad that Ben Affleck is not nominated for Best Director. The last third of that movie is, it's a cliche, but it's edge of your seat, hand-wringing, how will this happen?
Never happened.
Never happened.
Yeah. But
we go in
with that suspension of disbelief.
But here's the difference. And
says based on a true story at the beginning.
Okay. But here's the difference. We all know, as patrons going in, almost everyone, that it is based on a true story, right? This magnificent, crazy story, which it was,
right.
Inventing this fake movie. But I remember as that, you know, and everyone should know that things work out, right? And it's hard when you know the ending of a movie, how to make it suspenseful. This one is. But at the end, when there are these Iranian police cars coming up, and none of that happened. And here's the thing. If I had gone in to see just a movie that I didn't think was based on real life, and I saw that at the end, I would have said, that's too much. That would have never happened. But because I thought it was based on a true story, I said, it's crazy that they got through all of this. Except they didn't. The tickets had already been purchased by the Canadian embassy. They sailed through the airport.
Right. But that wouldn't be the most fun thing to watch.
Exactly. But I think it's an artistic cheat when you have a movie that most people think is based on real life where you can go over the top, which many viewers would not allow artistically to
happen. But wouldn't that be a screenplay concern more than Ben Affleck?
You're right. It's more of a script thing because it is a fun movie.
Yep.
And I really wish that John Goodman had earned a nomination, too.
Yeah, he's fun. Yeah. He's just as good as Alan Arkin,
right.
And Alan Arkin got in there. But,
yeah.
You know, it's interesting. We got 6 weeks to go. It's good that we're finally kind of catching up with some of these. And all in all, it's a good year so far.
Okay, by the time you and I next talk, I will have seen Life of Pi, Zero Dark Thirty, and Beasts of the Southern Wild.
Okay.
Thank you, Wayne.
Thank you.
If you're traveling to the North Country Fair, where the winds hit heavy on the borderline, remember me to one who lives there. For she once was a true love of mine. See for me that her hair's hanging down.
That is Bob Dylan, along with Johnny Cash, from the CD Nashville Skyline. The reason I'm playing Girl of the North Country there is because, although I had some criticisms with Silver Linings Playbook,
yes,
I think one of the best sequences I've seen in a movie in a long time involves a scene in that movie with this song playing behind it.
Okay.
It's a gorgeous scene.
Okay.
And I love it when a song that's 30 or 40 years old is put back into a film and used just perfectly.
Okay, I have to check this out.
Yeah, I love that song too. I need to make a correction.
Okay.
And this one. So yesterday at the end of the show, I said it's been a White River influence show.
Sure.
Because we did this story about the White River exhibit.
Right.
And I mentioned that Ralphie May grew up in Clarksville and the beautiful bridge there spans the White River.
Yeah, I think I kind of looked at you.
Yes, you did. With good reason, because it doesn't span the White River.
Okay.
It spans the Arkansas River.
Okay, that works.
So that correction.
Well, there you go. It's okay. There's too many rivers.
Yeah, but that's okay.
It's all right. We've got it cleared up for our purposes. Good deal.
Yes, we do.
Good deal. All right, we have tickets to give away. Well, we have a question asked, so we give away the tickets.
Two pairs of tickets to see Three Penny Acre and the Steel Wheels at George's Majestic Lounge Tuesday night. Music starts around 9 o'clock.
Okay. So I actually came up with the question today, and I'm pretty proud of this because I never come up with the question. But I didn't really come up with the question. I stole it from SportsCenter.
ESPN SportsCenter. That's okay. But it has a connection.
It does. Okay. So tonight in the NBA, the Boston Celtics are going to take on the New Orleans Hornets.
Yes. Go Hornets. And,
okay. New Orleans Hornets. And Doc Rivers is, of course, the coach of the Celtics.
Yes.
Well, his son Austin plays on the Hornets.
Yes.
So this morning they were talking about this will be the first time that they meet each other across the court and how that's all interesting because the kid has grown up with his father, you know, being a part of this organization. So they started listing off all of these other father-son
combinations,
coaches or fellow competitors, things like that. I think the most recent was the Pitinos. Rick Pitino in Louisville, basketball there. He went against his son, Richard, from, I think, Florida International University.
I believe you're right, yes.
And they had some other ones from a couple of NASCAR drivers, some more football, things like that. So what I want to know is in 2000, there was a father-son duo who met. And it involves the University of Arkansas.
So tell us who the father and son were.
Tell us who the father and son were. I won't tell you the sport. You can figure that out on your own.
That's
but I
right.
need the father and the son in 2000, November 17th, 2000, actually, if that helps you out.
OzarksAtLarge@gmail.com. All correct answers go into the ceramic cow, and we will pull the winners out. Go ahead.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, North Booth.
Where is North Booth?
North of Booth.
Oh, okay.
In Scott County.
Ozarks at Large, a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda.